Hey everyone, my name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on tips to avoid TCPA lawsuits. TCPA lawsuits these days can be very tricky in the post-ACA VSPC legal landscape. Knowing what is allowed and what is not allowed is nowhere close to being black and white. Today, we're fortunate to have a panel of compliance experts from across the credit and collection industry to share their secrets and strategies to help companies avoid TCPA lawsuits from ever darkening your doorstep. This webinar is being generously sponsored by NEA Insurance Group. You'll get the chance to hear a little bit more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the RM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the RM industry. For example, I just launched a podcast aimed at discussing the proposed debt collection rule from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau from the perspective of going section by section within the proposed rule and doing a deep dive on each section. And that was launched this week. You can find out more information about it at accountsrecovery.net. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insight to help educate and inform. At least my mother tells me that. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Dennis Barton is a managing attorney of the Barton Law Group. He specializes in collection litigation throughout Missouri and Illinois, nationwide consumer law defense, compliance, and is on ACA International CNR letter review panel. Dennis graduated from the Indiana University School of Business in 1996 and the Washington University School of Law in 2003. He is the Missouri Collectors Association past president and Missouri's ACA state compliance chair. Dennis is also a member of ACA International's MAP committee, education committee, and is an ACA certified instructor that presents nationwide on collection strategies, defense tactics, and compliance issues. Andrew Cove is a former senior assistant attorney general for Florida and the author of the bill which created Florida's Telemarketing Act. He has been representing telemarketers and other businesses on regulatory compliance and regulatory defense matters since he left the AG's office in 1989. His firm, Cove Law, represents clients nationwide and has significant experience in handling state licensing, TCPA, TSR compliance, state and federal investigations, FTC and AG enforcement actions, and private TCPA actions. Ari Rothman represents clients nationwide in all aspects of TCPA compliance and litigation matters. His extensive litigation experience includes obtaining a defense jury verdict in favor of his client, who faced a $2 billion exposure in a certified TCPA class action, as well as defeating class certification and obtaining other favorable defense outcomes in courts across the country. That experience enables him, based on real-life examples that played out in litigation in other adversarial settings, to devise and implement protocols designed to eliminate TCPA risk, negotiate contracts to mitigate exposure, and defend clients in all phases of TCPA litigation. Shaheen Rothermel advises clients on day-to-day issues arising out of telemarketing and text messaging promotions. Her familiarity with the ever-changing landscape of TCPA development helps her provide clients with creative solutions to achieve their goals while minimizing the risk of regulatory enforcement actions and TCPA class actions. Thanks to all our panelists for joining us today. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we will get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. As well, I want to take a minute and ask everyone to fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen when the webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that is what you're looking for and to help find the speakers you want to hear from. With that, I finished my introductory remarks. Let's get to our panel discussion and get you listening to all the experts who are here with us today. Dennis, you get the honor of the first question. In what areas are collection agencies most vulnerable when it comes to complying with the TCPA?
Well, in my experience, they're still most vulnerable in not making sure that the cell phone they have is the proper cell phone to the proper person, or that they have proper authorization. What I mean by that is, you know, in the cases in which I've been, you know, when I've defended my clients, you know, they scrubbed for the phone number, which is always a bad idea, or at least leaves, you know, a lot of opportunity for exposure. Or they obtained the number from the creditor, but it has since been reassigned. And so those are still the biggest ones. You know, making sure you have the right number other than those that have been reassigned is something that a policy procedures are really helpful to prevent. The reassignment, though, those are still tough. But the biggest areas where I see litigation are still where people are not making sure they have the right number. The other area where I see a lot of litigation is when the agency has the right number and they have authorization, but somewhere down the line, the consumer has called in and said, look, stop calling me, or stop calling this number. It's not properly documented. So, you know, when other collectors are going to then have conversations with this person or, you know, reviewing the file, they don't see that, and then they make further calls. And that creates a problem.
Yeah, I'll just add that I understand that I think it's the FCC is creating a reassigned numbers database that should make the reassigned number issue a little bit less of a concern. But like Dennis says, that essentially you have to have a protocol and train people properly and make sure that you're calling people that you have consent from. I don't think it's, you know, it's as simple as that, really, at the end of the day. Simple, but not.
And the other thing, too, is that when agencies have third parties who are doing the calling on their behalf, which is a lot of the time, making sure that those third parties are following policies and procedures, because we've seen some issues where third parties go rogue, they don't follow the procedures, and then you've gotten into a situation where, you know, the agency is being targeted by a class action plaintiff's attorney.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think in general, that's the third party vendors are the ones that really create exposure for any caller. So, you know, having contracts in place that protect you as much as they possibly can, even those, of course, don't really, they're not ironclad, but the third party callers have to be monitored, very carefully. They almost always do go rogue if you don't.
All right. Excellent. I love the idea of rogue third parties, just the images that are flashing around in my head. Dennis, you brought up the issue of consent, so let me ask a question to the panel. How should a collection agency integrate the concept or the requirement of obtaining consent into their conversations with individuals? Ari, maybe you want to take first chair on this one, this question? You there? Ari? Maybe we lost Ari. Does anyone else want to tackle this one first?
This is Dennis. I'd say that on top of maybe some of the normal, making sure that first is making sure you get documentation from the creditor that has phone numbers with it. You know, the creditor is going to give you the phone number. But oftentimes, making sure they have documentation is good. You know, where you see there's a signed agreement that had the number listed by the consumer. Now, I realize that at the time of placement, especially when there's so many accounts, sometimes you don't get documentation. And in those instances, make sure that you have an agreement. An agency should make sure it has an agreement with its creditor that creditor is only getting those numbers from the consumer rather than skipping on their own. Because I know there are some creditors that do that. So agencies that rely upon phone numbers that are given by the creditor need to make sure they know how the creditor got it and that the way in which the creditor got that number is proper to have authorization to call the number.
with respect to, you know, sort of where there is an instance, where there is a signed agreement, do you think it's plausible for a collection agency to get copies of all those signed agreements? Or is that just sort of something you need to sort of confirm that the creditor has it and can give it to the collection agency, a copy of it, if it's ever needed?
I think it's more the latter than the former. I guess it depends on the number of placements. You know, if there's 10 accounts, then sure, but that's not generally how this works. So generally 10,000 accounts or 1,000 accounts or whatever, right. Such a high number that documentation at the outset is often unrealistic. In fact, even if it was given, it's unrealistic that most agencies would have the person power to go through and review it all. So the best bet is to just make sure that your creditor, you know, is in line with you and fully understands the exposure. If they're not, that the way they get those numbers is going to is a proper way. And if it's not, they'll at least tell you so that you can make other business decisions based upon the risk.
Well, and even if they tell you they have it, perhaps without necessarily going through those records and taking up that manpower, perhaps, you know, just having a protocol in place to spot check, make sure that those numbers really are really have been obtained and they've been obtained properly, because otherwise you're looking at significant liabilities. Confirming that they've got the numbers in a proper manner. You know, trust and verify, I guess, at the same time.
You mentioned the concept of a spot check. Is there is that sort of looking at using a service and sending certain, like a sampling of phone numbers to that to sort of see if it's a cell phone or if it's a landline or sort of how do you advise they actually, you know, sort of do that spot check?
Well, I can't think of a concrete example where it's happened to me or my clients recently, but I don't imagine it would be difficult to put together some kind of a protocol where you at least every so often check the debt collectors or the creditors' records to make sure that they do have the leads, that they've collected them properly, that you're safe to continue with the relationship.
Andrew, I think that's a great point. You know, we emphasize vendor management so much in this industry, but sometimes you know, in an instance like this, you need to also have creditor management.
Sure, that liability runs both directions. I mean, the creditor is vicariously liable for what the callers do, what the debt collector does, but the debt collector has to be concerned that the leads are proper leads.
One other thing I want to throw in here as far as what a collection agency can do is from a practical standpoint, when they're on the phone with a consumer, they can simply ask, you know, what's the best phone number that we can reach you at? And generally, the answer they're going to get is going to be a cell number. But to verify it's a cell number, after getting the answer, just follow up with a, is that your cell number? I mean, that sounds simplistic, but it's highly effective.
Is there another question you have to ask? Is like, is it okay if I contact you on this number, you know, next time? Is that something you should ask on every conversation as well?
I was about to say that. I think you should ask more specific questions to get their consent. And to make sure that consent is valid. It's got to be knowing consent. You can't just, you know, passively collect the number or collect the number without telling the consumer what you're planning to do with it. I think the safer and more prudent way to go about it is to ask one or two follow-up questions and make sure that you have a record of it.
Excellent. Love the discussion so far. Really looking forward to continuing it. But at this point, what I'd like to do is pause the discussion, and I'd like to invite Otto Forster from NEA Insurance Group to say a few words as the sponsor of today's webinar. Otto?
Thanks, Mike. Just really appreciate the wonderful talent that's on the panel today. You know, these are true experts in the space of anything to do with the Telephone Communication Protection Act. There's a big wealth of knowledge here, and you know, utilizing these folks for spot checking your agreements or spot checking, you know, some procedures is a very, very prudent, you know, task from a risk management standpoint. You know, we as an agency work with insurance companies to help mitigate and defend these types of cases, but it's more of a backstop in a worst case scenario. I think that when you're in a business, you know, I liken this space a lot to, you know, running a hospital where you just know that a hospital will have a certain amount of medical malpractice lawsuits on a, you know, monthly, quarterly, annual basis. And so, you know, the owner of that hospital knows they're going to get sued. And so how do they, you know, fine tune their processes to mitigate the actual lawsuits when they do happen? You know, the catastrophic type of situations that can occur with regulatory bodies, or, you know, situations with contract issues, problems, consent, you know, plaintiff attorneys trolling around. These are big issues for anyone in the business of making phone calls. And the daily practice of really fine tuning your processes is so important, and utilizing the wealth of expertise that's here is really, I think, a big part of anyone's best practices from a risk management standpoint. You know, our role is more of a risk transfer role in the event of a catastrophic risk. And it's really important that you work hand in hand with these attorneys on a daily basis, weekly basis, whatever it has. But I'm just another guy trying to learn as much as I can from these true experts. So thank you, Mike. And looking forward to hearing more from Andrew, Shaheen, Ari, and Dennis.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Otto, and thanks again to you and NEA Insurance Group for sponsoring today's webinar. As a reminder to the audience, to ask questions and submit your questions, we have one that's come in that's on the topic of consent, and I wanted to ask it of the panel. If a consumer revoked consent to the original creditor, but the creditor didn't pass on that info to the collection agency, and the agency contacts the consumer, the question is, who is liable? Does anyone want to tackle that one?
Well, this goes back.
Jump at once.
Well, I was going to say this goes back to making sure that the creditor is doing what it needs to do, and how much you rely upon what the creditor has. I will tell you that I've not had this exact fact pattern, so I'm answering speculatively to some extent, but. You know, if you're getting the number as an agency and you're calling it and you're relying upon proper consent being given to the creditor, and if it wasn't given to the creditor, I don't think you would have it. And so I think you would be liable under the TCPA, or maybe not liable. I'll limit it to consent. I don't think you would have consent, and that would create exposure. Anybody else?
Right. And class action plaintiff's attorneys are just getting in the habit of just suing up and down the chain. They want to get money where they can. So, I mean, suing, you know, the creditor, the collection agency, if you know, somebody else is making the call, calling them, there's a lead gen in there, suing them too. I mean, because they, you know, if you think about it from a plaintiff's attorney standpoint, they want to get money where they can. So it is a good point, who is liable, but it's also, you know, who is going to get sued might be the other question there. And the answer is oftentimes it's, you know, everybody the plaintiff's attorneys can find.
Yeah, that's my experience as well. They'll sue everybody they can, and it makes perfect sense. In light of the fact that TCPA is almost, but not quite, a strict liability statute. In other words, it almost doesn't matter what your excuse is. There are exceptions, but if you're calling someone and you don't have consent, even if you've gotten the number from the creditor, you're going to get sued, and it'll be difficult to extricate yourself. Although I think in that specific fact pattern, the collector may be able to extricate himself once all is said and done. But it's certainly a problem. They won't be able to avoid staying in the litigation.
Something Andrew said earlier about having contracts with the creditor, and you know, I forget if he said indemnification clause, but if not, this is a time where an indemnification clause is more important than ever. A lot of times in FDCPA cases, even when the creditors kind of set the agency up for failure, a lot of agencies won't try to exercise that indemnification clause when it's $4,000 or $5,000 on the line, fearing they'll lose lose the business, and that's probably a legitimate fear. But when we're talking about the incredible money that is sometimes at stake in a TCPA case, those indemnification clauses are very important and could come into play in a fact pattern like this.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a very good point. Like you said, you'll pick and choose perhaps when to actually enforce that indemnification clause or hold harmless agreement, but it's good to have in your back pocket.
And one thing on the indemnification clause too is making sure that, you know, the indemnification is backed by something so that whoever you're getting that indemnity from has some sort of money to pay, whether that's directly or through insurance or otherwise.
To ask for a personal guarantee too, if you're not sure. That's what we've done in the past too, in those kinds of situations as well. And then also in these contracts, and I'm sorry that I'm just now being unmuted because I didn't know how to work the computer. Going back to these contracts, the other thing that might be beneficial is putting in audit rights and seeing how consent was obtained to begin with. A lot of the times we're told that the person who collected the phone number obtained consent. We are explained how consent was obtained. And then when we ask, okay, well, show us the website, show us the form, show us the signature, show us the path, we're empty-handed because that information either wasn't never collected or it wasn't saved. And so getting consent is one thing that has to be done, but proving it is something else. And if you're a defendant defending one of these claims, the burden, most courts almost, I think it's uniform now, it's an affirmative defense on which the defendant carries the burden to prove it. And if you are representing the party that did not make the call and relying on somebody else to get the consent, then you need to get that consent information either as a matter of course before a lawsuit hits or as soon as thereafter as possible and have contractual rights and ability to do it.
Excellent. Good information. Another question from the audience. How do you treat phones that come in under a family plan where one person owns the phone number, but the phone is used and maybe the consent is provided by someone else? Does anyone want to take
a
crack at that?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I guess that question wins the prize for stumping the panel.
Normally, like we run into those situations sometimes, and it's normally corrected right away by the plaintiff's lawyers by just putting in the right person. Now, in the debt collection context, it might be a little bit more difficult because if the two people are different, then the call might not have been intended for the person that ultimately received it or paid for the phone line. But if consent was, I mean, I think that's a tough nut to crack for the plaintiff's lawyers, because then even if you assume that the person called was different than the person who provided consent, but they're on the family plan, if these cases are create exposure based on class certified classes and everything else, you've got a good class certification defense. Because if if the other class members provided consent in the way that consent should have been provided, and this is a one-off, then you just should go right to the plaintiff's lawyers and tell them, you know, maybe you have a claim here with this individual fact situation, maybe you don't, but you definitely don't have it for all these other 9,999 people that are in your proposed class. And so they're out, and so you can knock it out that way.
Also have a good argument that the person who gave you the number kind of set you up for failure and set up the other people to get your calls. Now, that's employing concepts of fairness and common sense, which are foreign to our industry. But, you know, I think that too would be a defense. That's something I'd have to research candidly. But if you ever ask a question, if you want to follow with Mike and give a name, I'd be happy to try to get you an answer.
I mean, that's a great point, because that also goes to typicality and commonality.
It does.
Under class cert principles, under straight up Rule 23 principles. So that's exactly the point, is you've got a unique situation here that is unlike everybody else that receive these calls, and therefore you can't certify class. So here's your $500.
Let's move to another discussion topic. And I know that a lot of different courts have, you know, issued a lot of different rulings. So I'm curious if there is a an ATDS definition or what defines an ATDS that most courts are currently using in relation to TCPA lawsuits? Is there a consensus or a couple of different sort of definitions that are winning out more than any others, and something that collection agencies can sort of use depending on where they're located?
Well, I think the answer is that most courts are following the ACA decision from last year, which narrowed the definition of an ATDS. But there is a conflict in the courts. I believe it's the Ninth Circuit that recently ruled that they basically ruled, without getting too esoteric, they had a broader definition, an older kind of view of what an ATDS was or is. And but that conflict between the various circuits, so most courts are following a narrower interpretation of what an ATDS is now, ever since this ruling last year. But to settle that dispute, to settle that conflict, there is a case that's been brought up, brought to the Supreme Court, and hopefully they'll settle the dispute, they'll settle the conflict.
This is Dennis. In yesterday's webinar, Mike Frost called negotiating with plaintiffs poker. And to some extent, I think there's a poker game going on when it comes to the ATDS definition and how you handle and defend cases. I recently had one where if the court were to have assumed it was an ATDS, the damages were going to be extremely high. But if not, then the defense would win. And so that played a large part in how that case was settled, and settled for a lot lower than it otherwise would have, because I think both sides are, realize that there's not a settled decision yet.
Well, it is discomforting as a broad question, but it also depends what circuit you happen to reside in. If you're in the Ninth Circuit, the plaintiff's attorneys have a bit of an argument that a broader definition applies. If you're in the Third or D.C. Circuit, it sort of tends to favor the defense the defense side, at least until the conflict is resolved. But it is certainly discomforting for everyone involved to know that the definition is not now settled right now. So it gives everyone a little bit of an argument in every case.
Well, that's a great point, because I'm in the Eighth Circuit, and it hasn't really there's no case that even indicates what direction it would go when this question is presented to it. In fact, in the Eastern District of Missouri, there have been, back when we were waiting to find out the answer, waiting for the ACC decision to come down, some judges were granting stays and some judges weren't within the same district. So
right.
Kind of a crapshoot as to how things were going to be handled.
Right, it is a bit of a crapshoot.
Right, which is why, it's still this unsettled decision, unsettled definition creates problems for both sides, especially ours, because the real risk is on our side.
And I suspect that no one knows what the Supreme Court will do, but I suspect that they'll end up coming down on the side that looks at the ATDS with a narrower definition, the same. I'm guessing they're going to affirm what the ACA case said, what the DC Circuit said, and narrow the definition, because as that court said, under the old definition, the one that the Ninth Circuit's trying to use, almost anything can be an ATDS. Your cell phone can be an ATDS. Under that broad definition, merely having a device that can store a lot of numbers can potentially be an ATDS. The narrower definition requires that the ATDS actually produce the numbers. Hopefully that's what's going to happen, and we'll end up with a narrower definition going forward.
So we've talked poker, we've talked craps, I guess we should maybe move on to the blackjack or slot machines next, as we continue with our analogy through the Las Vegas Strip. I'm just curious, based on everything we've talked about so far and based on everything that's out there with respect to sort of the uncertainty surrounding the TCPA, should collection agencies be more or less inclined to settle TCPA lawsuits rather than fight them, given that there is so much legal, or appears to be so much legal uncertainty, and by all means, correct me if I'm wrong, which means that cases may have to sort of be litigated for a fair amount of time and a fair amount of expense before an agency may get a favorable ruling. Is it just better to settle these days or not better? I'm curious what everyone thinks. Ari, would you give us your perspective?
I mean, I always think that looking at an early dismissal or settlement is economically superior than litigating one of these cases. And so putting aside the precedent that it might set and the, you know, natural response that it's a shakedown or whatever, you know, drive-by shooting or whatever other analogy you want to use, in the long run, it tends to be less operationally disruptive and cheaper if a resolution can be reached sooner rather than later. And so I'm always for settlements, putting aside what my views are about the merits of the cases and how they're brought and how they're litigated. At the same time, there are certain situations where you don't want to make your client, or your client doesn't want to look like it is a soft target. And there are strategies to deal with that. I mean, sometimes it takes some educating to the other side and projecting and litigating in order to convince the other side that if there's going to be any settlement at all, it's going to be something that is going to be more about what we want and less about what you want. Otherwise, you know, you have a lot of risk here, putting money into the case, putting on experts for the auto dialer issue, almost always notice cost, notice experts, and who knows what else, depending on what kind of case it is, explaining how lead generators work to the jury, for example, improving consent. And that could all get flushed down the toilet the second they lose class certification or lose a trial. So, you know, while I think that there are some cases that are worth litigating and worth defending, if we're looking at this to minimize disruption to our clients and minimize their legal spend, looking at a settlement on a case-by-case basis is something that I encourage our clients to do early. If it's not the right time, then it's not the right time. You can always revisit settlement later. But I don't know that I would go so far as to say you should settle all these cases the second they come in, because you might be inviting repeat lawsuits from the same lawyers and that sort of thing. So, you know, do some diligence and pressure testing before you agree to settle, but definitely look at it and don't dismiss it out of hand.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think in general, you want to try to settle these cases if you can, but there are exceptions, and the facts do matter, of course, and the allegations matter, whether it's a large class or not, and whether your client's deep pocket or not. Almost all these facts matter, but as a general proposition, even a mediocre settlement is worth shooting for almost always. These cases are disruptive and expensive to defend. I think most of the time we're better served resolving them.
So then, to Dennis's comment earlier, referencing a webinar I did yesterday on pre-litigation demand letters, does it become a game of poker then? If you're looking sort of, if you know you're going to settle, then is it just a matter of trying to negotiate the lowest amount possible? Is that the best way out in some of these cases?
Well, sure, most of the time, but it is a game of poker. There are all the variables you have in a poker game. You look at your hand and you look at his hand, and you kind of have to figure out whether you have a shot if you end up fighting out in court. But like in poker, a lot of it's bluffing and bluster and posturing, and hopefully you end up with a settlement that's south of what you where your pain threshold is. But I know in general, I encourage my clients to settle. That's a function of the fact that they're usually, you know, very exposed. There are exceptions, though. And like Ari said, one big consideration is whether this is going to create a precedent, whether this plaintiff's attorney is going to become an adversary over and over again. I've seen that a few times too.
And there are ways to mitigate that. I mean, we have to, you can only go so far as attorneys because under every, you know, state bar rule that I'm aware of, you can't foreclose or preclude a plaintiff's lawyer from never suing your client again in the future. And you can't even ask them to do that. And that's not something that we do, but there are other ways to smoke them out and, you know, get representations and warranties from them about what their current intentions are and so on. And I've only, you know, I've only had a plaintiff's lawyer come back against the same client once. And when that happened, it was nuclear war. And so, you know, that's sort of what we have to do so we can project to other lawyers and clients that, and plaintiff's lawyers that if you're going to be a repeat customer, there isn't going to be a settlement in the future. Right. One shot, unless you tell us. And if you tell us you're coming back after, you know, you're going to come back at us after we settle this case, then we'll take that into consideration about settling. But there are ways to smoke it out without violating the legal ethical rules.
I agree with all of that. And I think that applies to all suits of all kinds, these repeat filers. I will say that my clients who choose to defend always over time see a dramatic drop in the amount of lawsuits filed against them versus clients who are, you know, very risk adverse and want to settle each and every time. Mm-hmm. One other comment I'd have on this settle or not settle. You know, for those cases, I represent a lot of small and medium-sized companies. And so if there's a lawsuit and the other side's asking for $300,000 or, you know, some number that would just shut the door, then we have no choice to defend. And then it comes into the poker player mentality comes in, and just to tell the other side, look, you know, we're going to defend this case because there's not the numbers. I mean, we don't really have a choice. If you want to come down, you can come down to a number we can talk about. But otherwise, we're just going to defend and hope the court sides with us on the ATDS matter. If not, you know, we're – under taking a judgment or taking your settlements, the same outcome for us. So in those cases, I, you know, highly advise fighting, or at least, you know, showing the desire to fight in order to try to negotiate something that's rational and, you know, able to be paid by the client.
Okay. There's actually some data that indicates the number of TCPA lawsuits filed against collection agencies is down about 12% through the first 4 months of 2019 compared to the first 4 months of 2018. I know it may not feel like it, but to a lot of companies, but the numbers do appear to be declining. Is that a trend that you expect to continue? And if you do or don't, why or why not? Shaheen, you want to take a first crack at that one, please?
Sure. I mean, the thing that I would say is that, you know, that number reflects the number of lawsuits that are filed, not necessarily the, you know, the pre-suit demands and out-of-court confidential settlements that I think Dennis was just talking about. So, you know, having said that, I haven't seen a decline in terms of those demands on my clients, either in the collections vertical or otherwise. But I am interested to hear about the other panelists to see if they've had, you know, they think that these are going down maybe because of the uncertainty on the ATDS issues or the, you know, the other sort of things that are pending at the FCC.
Well, I think one of the reasons, I mean, Sheen, I think one of the things you and I have noticed in our practice is that the debt collection cases are going down, but the strength of the non-debt collection cases from the plaintiff side are growing strong. Like, you know, 5-10 years ago, we would get these cases in the door where there'd be shaky consent and sometimes there'd be outright consent, yet the plaintiff's lawyers would still file them. Now it seems to me that the plaintiff's lawyers are finding the easier fruit to pick off the tree and going after that, and that is the debt collection, because now the debt collectors have gotten wise to it and they have more advanced protocols than they did, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago, which is to say the industry is doing a better job of getting consent, tracking consent, and making sure all those protocols are in place. And a lot of plaintiff's lawyers will look at that, I think, you know, I'm trying to get in their heads and sort of move away from it because they know that that's going to be a challenge that they have versus the non-debt collector cases, which are like, you'd be surprised how many cases we see where there is no effort to obtain consent at all. And those are just the cases that you have no defense for, except possibly automatic telephone dialing system, which, as we know, is only a 50-50 proposition. And you're probably going to have a certified class by the time that issue is decided anyway, if you have a judge that doesn't want to deal with that issue until after class cert. So that's sort of my thinking on it, because we handle all these cases from all kind, not just debt collection cases, and the percentage is very skewed right now, non-debt collection cases.
My experience dovetails very much with Ari's. I've got a very broad variety of clientele, and what I'm seeing is that the larger businesses, whether they're debt collectors or otherwise, they've become conscious of this whole TCPA issue. They're a little more, their consciousness has been raised. They've got protocols in place. So the big fat cats are no longer getting hit as much as they were 5 or 10 years ago. Certainly not. But the smaller telemarketer call centers, those guys are still doing stupid shit and getting caught. And for the most part, those are not formal actions. Since they have us dead to rights, we usually do have to work something out with our adversaries. So I'm not seeing as many big, big defendant cases, but I do think it's still a target-rich environment for plaintiffs if they're satisfied with sort of the smaller fish.
Mike, I would ask, kind of to dovetail off that question to the group here, from a, I think Mike's question is more about frequency. I'm interested a little bit more in severity. Maybe the numbers are showing the frequency of claims or suits are down slightly, but are numbers trending up? Where are numbers in terms of payouts? What does that look like? What are you guys seeing there?
Well, in light of what I just said, the numbers I'm seeing are smaller because I'm defending a lot of smaller TCPA claims. And when our clients, I was going to say something about this earlier when Dennis was speaking about this, when our clients really are very small businesses, in some cases, if they're willing, we can even be transparent about that, the fact that their revenues are very mild or not significant. And sometimes that prompts a settlement. Sometimes we just decide to be a little more transparent than we otherwise need to be at that stage in the litigation, and it can help make the deal work.
My experience is a little bit different. Well, this is Dennis, and I only do, I'm only in the debt collection industry. I don't have TCPA clients outside of that. But for my clients for whom I both do the collection and the defense work, they're all seeing their TCPA cases drop, not because the plaintiffs are just, don't want to file them. In our instance, it's because the agencies have done a better job. I think Ari kind of mentioned that before. Their policies and procedures are better. They're making sure they don't skip for numbers. They're making sure that, before they're just more sensitive to it. And they're more aware of the issue of consent and to make sure they're complying with it, which I guess is really the goal of the TCPA, which is to motivate that type of behavior. And it's done so with a lot of my clients.
Okay, good. We've talked a little bit about the activity at the Federal Communications Commission. One of the things they're working on is a proposed rule or declaratory rule, sort of updating the TCPA or the changes to the TCPA following the ACA lawsuit. Is that something that should be giving collection agencies an opportunity to seek stays in any pending cases as they await that rule, or is that something that they're not likely to get, given that there's really sort of no timeline as to when this proposed rule is going to be released, let alone become a final rule?
I think not likely to get.
I don't think you're likely to get it, but I don't know. Look, I'm a never hurts to ask kind of guy, and it doesn't, you know, from an expense standpoint, from a law, you know, legal fees standpoint, it doesn't take much to put something like this together. So it's not going to cost the client that much. And if the dollars are high, and there's a real benefit to getting a stay, I would tell my clients it's worth rolling the dice, even though the probability of a win is low because the expense is low.
Well, I guess even without, even if it is unlikely to get, it does color the case a little bit for both the court and the plaintiff, plaintiff's attorney. So I guess there's some merit in just changing their expectations a little bit in that sort of vague way. But I don't see judges waiting. I don't see judges giving you a stay most of the time.
Okay, good advice. You know, as many of you know, the CFPB earlier this month came out with a proposed debt collection rule. A lot of what the CFPB proposed had an impact on how collection agencies are going to communicate, especially through text messaging and phone calls with individuals. Is there any impact that you think the proposed debt collection rule is going to have on the either to Otto's point before, either the number or the severity of TCPA lawsuits? Or is it still just a little too early to tell as we wait a final rule?
It's early for me to tell, and it's a very lengthy proposal too. So I don't know that many of us have digested it yet. Something like 500 pages.
Yes, yes, it was. Great bedtime reading. Okay, that's fine. There was a recent ruling in the Fourth Circuit. The case is American Association of Political Consultants, VFCC, which actually ruled on the constitutionality of the TCPA related to certain exemptions for collecting or for dealing with debts that are owed to or guaranteed by the federal government. Curious if there's any advice as to how agencies should react or adapt their processes in the wake of that ruling, or anything that's going to come out of that ruling going forward.
In my review of the case, it seemed to have a pretty big focus on free speech. So when you're going to translate that over to the debt collection side, the factual distinctions seem so significant that I don't know if it's going to have much of an effect, much of a help for us.
Okay, no problem. I got about 10 minutes left. So if anyone has a question for anyone on the panel, that would probably be your best chance to type it in to make sure we get it answered before the webinar wraps up. Moving on to my next question. Are there ways that, you know, we've talked sort of a lot about what happens when a lawsuit does get filed. Are there ways that collection agencies can preemptively seek to avoid TCPA lawsuits? I'm sure someone, you know, we can make the joke, don't break the law, and you know, you don't have anything to worry about. But, you know, are there anything, you know, any advice that any of you have for people who might be listening in now or to the recording as to how they can preemptively avoid TCPA lawsuits in the first place?
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to that, but it's mostly common sense, having a protocol and training everyone properly and making sure it's all thought about in advance, and essentially having a compliance program in place prevents a lot of these problems. I don't think there's anything magic about it. It's just a matter of being thoughtful about it.
To play off that, I would say that, this is Dennis, and I would say that the best thing you can do as an organization is to make sure that you have the right policies and procedures in place. When I say have the right ones, I mean not only you know what the right thing is, but you put it in writing, and then you've made sure that your people know about it, and that you've, you know, trained your people, especially new employees, especially those with very little knowledge or experience with the industry. And I mean, that's the best thing. because it isn't rocket science. And so when it comes to TCPA issues, and so just making sure that everybody's on board with knowing what the right thing to do is, and that they're properly trained and consistently trained, and there's follow-up to make sure that they're doing the right thing, that's probably the best thing an organization can do to comply with the TCPA.
Making sure they have good counsel, making sure they have good advice, and that they're educated to start with.
Excellent, good idea. A question that came in, or sort of more of a comment, but I'm curious what everyone thinks of the idea. With respect to what we were talking about earlier about asking for an individual for a number, confirming it's a cell phone, asking for consent, do you recommend asking the consumer if it's okay to leave a pre-recorded message for them on that particular number in the future? Is that a question that should be part of that that conversation?
It should, if you want to leave pre-recorded messages.
That was a very quick answer. Simple enough.
Yeah.
I'd like to circle back to something we were talking a little bit about earlier. With respect to settling cases, how do you, I wanted to sort of, maybe just talk for a few minutes. I know we mentioned it briefly, but talk for a few minutes about how you sort of settle a case, but don't necessarily hang an open for business sign up on your door, that you're going to be, you're going to do this every time a lawsuit's filed. I guess the question is, how do you make it as difficult as possible for a plaintiff and still sort of settle a case? Is there any advice or insight you can provide in that area? Anybody?
Well, this is Ari. I mean, if it's a pre-suit demand, then that means that it can be settled theoretically, confidentially, without any filing, notifying the judge of a settlement, or even, you know, what some might view as a, you know, notice of dismissal. You know, some people can infer from that a settlement has been made, even if the notice of dismissal or stipulation of dismissal doesn't say anything about it. So it's completely quiet. And theoretically, if you have a strong confidentiality provision and you trust the plaintiff and the law firm, then that is the quickest, and you do the smoke out pieces that we talked about earlier, where you make sure they're not going to come back to the same client and make sure they know that if they do, it's all out war. You know, doing all of those things on the front end before a lawsuit is filed is the best way to avoid anybody even knowing that you got the letter, much less that you responded to it and settled it. Likewise, if a case has been filed, because some of these class action lawyers, they file the case, they want to file it quickly without a pre-suit demand to avoid pickoffs, and because they want to be the first in line when it comes to being appointed as class counsel, that also is your opportunity to get rid of it quickly. Because if you get rid of it fast, and especially if it's before you've even appeared or answered the complaint, then nobody's going to even know necessarily, unless there's a proof of service or summons or something like that on the docket, that you even got the complaint or responded to it or whatever your client did. So you could do it quickly then. Now, if you can't get a deal done or you don't want to do it early, then another way to avoid not putting a for sale sign, on your front door or your back door or whatever it is litigate the case for some time. File a motion to dismiss if you have it, whether it's a standing issue or some mistake or whatever it is, or just answer it and then proceed to discovery and project through your filings that you're going to fight this tooth and nail. And then if there is a settlement later, what you've done is you projected to your opponent that you're just not going to lay down and write a check. So there's various ways to do it. And at the end of the day, a logical plaintiff's lawyer is going to understand that there's business decisions on the other side that are being made. It has nothing necessarily to do with exposure. It has to do with, you know, let's get rid of this now so you don't have to pay more later and we'll contain our exposure. So those are the things that we typically do. And And it's rare, again, I think it's happened once that I know of, where the same lawyer has come back against the same client in terms of multiple lawyers going after the same client. I can't, you know what it, no one ever really knows, but I think in those situations, it's more of because it's, there's a lot of volume going out by any particular client in different parts of the country or the world. And they just sort of get, chalk it up as a cost of doing business rather than seeing it as a coordinated attack by a bunch of plaintiff's lawyers. So there are ways to do it.
I would agree with the pain in the ass doctrine that Ari is advising. These guys are bulk filers, and oftentimes, which means they have a whole bunch of cases and they're just trying to get them all settled and make a buck and move on down the road. I'm a collection attorney. And what I don't like is when the other side has a defense attorney who files a whole bunch of discovery and a bunch of motions. So while I'm not going to drop the case, it slows things down, and I hate it. And so with these guys, if you can do the reverse, they're just like collection attorneys. They are bulk filers, and they have a system, and they want to get things done quick. And so the harder you make it, the less likely they'll come knocking on your door again, even if you have to eventually settle.
Good advice. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left before we wrap up, but before everyone starts rushing to leave the webinar, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and give each of our speakers a chance to summarize their thoughts or share any other key takeaways, or maybe talk about something they didn't get a chance to talk about because the discussion didn't go that way, but they thought it was worth mentioning. Just a chance to sort of wrap up, maybe share any last thoughts before we end for today. So if you don't mind, Shaheen, would you go first, please?
Sure. And Mike, you asked a little bit earlier about the CFPB rule and what the effect would be. What I would say is that if some of the pieces of the proposed rule actually do become regulation or a rule, then I think it will really help, compliance with that rule will really help reduce the risk of TCPA lawsuits. So one thing would be reducing the number of calls. Whenever we say volume of calls is correlated with the risk of a lawsuit. So that would be one thing I'd say. The other thing too is broadly construing opt-out requests. So making sure that when those calls are being made, if somebody's asking to opt out or revoking consent, to do that and listen to complaints, monitor those complaints. I know we've talked a lot about auditing and whatnot, but that's something in particular that should be looked at.
Awesome, excellent, thank you. Ari?
As a plaintiff's lawyer once told me, TCPA cases are the hardest cases for the plaintiffs to lose. And I sort of go into these matters with that orientation and do everything. The climate is still bad. It's still very favorable for the plaintiffs and very lucrative if they hit the right target. So going back to the beginning of the call where we were talking about compliance and implementing protocols and making sure everything like that is shored up, that is by far and away the most effective way and cheapest way to avoid these things from happening. And if you do, if your clients do a lot of volume or you do a lot of volume and you get hit by one of these lawsuits, you're going to be prepared, better prepared to respond to it than to the other 99 defendants that the same plaintiff's lawyer sued that same day. So preparation is key. Ongoing monitoring and compliance is key. And addressing these things quickly, in my opinion, is key. But the climate is still very plaintiff favorable. And I don't see the courts letting go of these cases anytime soon.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate those three keys. Andrew, you're up.
Well, I guess following the same theme, I think, all of this is good advice. Plan ahead, be systematic, respect the compliance aspects of your business. I think simply putting a little time and money into all this at the start, the compliance side of things at the start, it'll be money well spent. These cases are very much worth avoiding. I guess that's it. I just want to thank you for inviting me too.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Dennis, you get the honor of the last word today.
Thanks. All right. So from a practical takeaway, if I was an agency owner, I would make sure, or manager, I would make sure that when you're training your employees, that you make distinctions between TCPA and FDCPA requirements. And one of the ones that is important is cease and desist. And under the FDCPA, it has to be in writing or you don't have to recognize it. Now, a lot of agencies might recognize verbal cease and desist requests anyway, but you don't need to. It has to be in writing. With the TCPA, though, that is not true. If someone says stop calling, you have to stop calling that number. That number was the cell phone that you've been calling. You need to stop, and if you continue, it'll be a TCPA violation. So it's those small distinctions that you need to make with people. We're in an industry with so much information, and it can be overwhelming sometimes, which is why written policies and procedures are so important to make sure that people thoroughly understand and grasp and retain the information that you provide to them in their training. Thanks. And thanks for having me.
Awesome. Excellent. Well, thank you, Dennis. And thanks again to Ari, Shaheen, Andrew, and Dennis for their insights and their time today. Really appreciate them taking time out of their schedule to share such important and insightful information with us. Also want to thank Auto and NEA Insurance Group for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to jmprivateinsurance.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. One final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar to help identify topics and speakers that will be of the best use to you. A recording of this event will be posted later today to accountsrecovery.net for anyone who wants a copy of it. And please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, awesome job today. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.